Welcome to part two of our 1994 conversation. This is your host, Nathaniel, from The Film Experience. I'm here with Nick Davis, who's a professor at Northwestern, Eric Anderson of Awards Watch, Alfred Soto, who's a freelance critic and editor, and Tony winner Itamar Moses, who wrote the book for The Band's Visit and also writes plays and television. At the end of the first part of our discussion, we were discussing Diane Weiss' Oscar win in Bullets Over Broadway and whether our knowledge of someone's Oscar win colors our opinions of the performance in retrospect, which is definitely true. So we return to the conversation about Bullets Over Broadway. That is true, yeah.
It's on
I think that's justified, though, because like Nick said, she had just won pretty recently. Well, not recent, but I mean enough. And so, yeah, a second win, you know, should give a little bit more.
That's true.
In her direction.
Well, see, this is why I think for her the two wins is justified, is those characters could not be any more different. Yes. Which is what I always find so fascinating about them. And actually, with her other nomination in between them, is completely different than those two characters as well. So it's her Academy history has so much more range in it than almost any other actor that's been nominated frequently.
It's true. And an interesting asterisk to this, did you know that she's still the only actor in history to win in the same category, giving performances for the same director?
Yep.
That's interesting.
Until Roberto Benigni directs himself to a second one.
Don't speak.
Right. I always think, one thing I always think when I'm watching Bullets Over Broadway is I really want to see this fucking play, God of Our Fathers, or whatever it's called. Because I can't imagine how it actually plays. Even though they give you so many details about it, I still am like so curious about it.
I know it's almost like the rehearsals are just such great little gems, and I'm like, oh my god, just keep going.
Well, Woody Allen was just young enough to have been aware of Clifford Odets, so I think he would have known that style, and that's the part of the movie that works for me. I mean, he seems to have been able to reproduce leftist agitprop dialogue in a way that it's easy, that was even hilarious at the time, unintentionally so.
Just that it's also kind of odd then that, like, when he has to write dialogue for leftist artists in the cafe, he really struggles. You know?
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, he always has, that to me is an example of, like, a larger problem with Woody Allen's writing, especially an increasing one where, like, where he's just not trusting the audience to, like, understand what something is about. And then, you know, like the way Melinda and Melinda or whatever it is begins with an argument with two writers where they're like, comedy is better. No, tragedy is better. Well, let's find out. Just gonna say, or like Match Point starts with like, what is the role of luck in our lives? Like, let's take a look. Feels like a little bit like that. Anyway, sorry, yeah.
Well, see, I like, interesting that you brought up Melinda and Melinda, because that's my sticking point in his career about, like, what went wrong on that movie, because I don't actually mind a gimmick movie having a framing device like that. But then the comedy is not funny, so there's no difference between one Melinda and the other Melinda. And we obviously know he can do funny. So it was a very strange movie experience. I'm assuming all of you saw it in the theater back in the day. Do we have any interesting anecdotes from that? Because I know everybody will have a Pulp Fiction anecdote.
Any interesting bullets anecdotes?
Anecdotes, yeah, from seeing it.
I saw it opening day. I'm not going to say, I vehemently deny that it's the greatest film I've ever seen, but it was certainly, as far as movie going experiences go, it's top two or three. You really did feel at the time, sitting in that theater that Friday night, that you were watching something seminal. The audience felt it. When you're walking out of the theater, all you wanted to do was talk about it. And in a sense, what your criticism, my criticisms, p- pale beside the experience of watching it.
Mm-hmm. For me, 94-95 was exactly when I started shifting. Like, I was interested in writing and maybe becoming a writer, but that was the year I wrote my first play and, like, started to think more seriously about playwriting. So my memory of seeing this movie is feeling a little bit indicted. Like, I think it plucked at my fear that I was a fraud, that I wanted to be a part of the wrong reasons, and that I just wanted, like, whatever, you know, it's ludicrous to say, to look back on now, but, like, whatever cachet, you know, like, oh, and that really, like, there was that this figure of the real artist who's the hitman who sort of just knows how to tell stories and isn't invested in his image or whatever. I don't know. I think I remember feeling, I remember feeling alarmed, like, oh God, is this going to be me? And also, they made a musical of Bullets Over Broadway recently, yeah, in the last few years. And I'm going to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about why it doesn't work. The movie is really good. It's a very well-structured story. And that's a great starting point for a musical. The problem that they ran into was, rather than sort of cannibalize aspects of the script and turn them into songs, like, let's take this part and make it a set piece, song, musical number, or whatever, they just added songs. And they added, I think, like, what were they, Tin Pan Alley songs, or like some sort of songs from the era, I guess. So basically, you take a movie that's at the perfect length at about 2 hours or whatever it is, and you make it 2 hours and 40 minutes just by adding non-narrative musical breaks. And then you sort of wonder why it didn't succeed. That's my review of the musical.
No, I totally get it. And the funny, I'm glad that you brought that up, because when I was preparing for the SmackDown, I thought, one question I'm going to ask on the SmackDown is, which of these four movies would you adapt into a musical? And then I remembered that Bullets Over Broadway had already become a musical.
Yeah. Yeah. And not, you can't, I don't think you could do a musical of Pulp Fiction either.
Oh my God.
So
oh my God. Doesn't mean only, nobody only, would try.
Only if Helen Sinclair is in it.
Right. I think Madness of King George is probably the answer, but I don't know that would work either.
Yeah. I could imagine a couple solo numbers, though.
Yeah. I mean, or the real answer is Bullets Over Broadway is the correct answer.
Yeah.
You'd have to do it different. You'd have to
accept that it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. You'd have to actually make a musical.
Screw you all. I'm writing Viv.
Viv with an exclamation point. Flow.
Yes. And see, now we have a point of view and a protagonist, so it's already better.
There you go.
And Pulp Fiction, I know, Edamar, you said that you saw this a million times. I saw it a million times in the theater, too.
Are we not going to talk about Jennifer Tilly? Are we leaving Bullets?
Oh, shit.
Without Olive?
Yeah. Charmed, charmed.
Charmed, charmed. Oh, my God. So the rest of the podcast is just going to be doing lines from Jennifer Tilly, right?
She is so funny, and I remember her being the surprise nominee. That performance has never lost any of its hilarity. Mm-mm. Like, every moment. And one of my favorite things about it is the way she doesn't ever seem to be paying attention to anyone else, except for that her vocal code switching that happens is so funny, because it's always around her catching something and not quite understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
Or
the exception is when somebody gives her a present.
Yes, or when someone gives her a present was my next thing.
Talcum powder! You're a doll! You're a doll! You're a doll!
And I had completely forgotten. I've seen this movie a bunch of times too, but I'd completely forgotten about her affair with the, I forget the character's name, Werner.
Yeah.
Jim Broadbent's character. And even that scene is just, it doesn't feel like any of her other scenes, but it absolutely feels like who Olive Neil would be. So I think she's perfect in this movie.
Yeah, she is perfect. She is absolutely flawless in this. It's, you know, playing a bad actress is a obviously a super difficult role to pull off. And I think for most people, this was a big introduction to Jennifer Tilly. They knew who Meg Tilly was, but this was really her big coming out. So there really wasn't like much you could attach to Jennifer Tilly, like, oh, she's a great actress, and now she's playing a bad actress. Mm-hmm. So one of the super wonderful things about that is just the lack of baggage. So you just kind of got to enjoy the performance for what it was. I just think it's flawless.
Alfred, you're not convinced, right?
Yeah, I want to hear from him because he didn't like, because I love her performance too. I think she's great. So
I'm sitting here glowering like Chaz Palminteri.
You're a bad actress.
Yeah. It could be my reluctance to embrace actors playing bad actors. I mean, I have a similar problem with Born Yesterday. I've never been the biggest fan of that movie either. So I think she's fine. It's not a role I'm in love with. But to me, it's just another example of how Bullets Over Broadway is just a car of recycled parts, you know. And while I can accept that all of y'all see some nuance and range in the way Tilly articulates her self-obsession, and certainly the way she pretends to act, it's nothing more than just she's okay to watch. Let's leave it at that.
I take back what I said earlier that your opinions are broadening mine. That's no, absolutely not.
I guess what impresses me about the performance, and it's basically what I said in the blurb, is the lack of. I think it's brave to give a performance that's so potentially unappealing. I think a lot of actors are concerned with their, you know, not even just being likable, but being cool or being impressive in some way. And this character is just so annoying and like stupid and unpleasant, but the character doesn't care, you know, and she clearly doesn't, Tilly doesn't care either. Like, I don't know. I just find it, like inspiring in some way, but like it's so the lack of vanity in the performance, I guess, is impressive to me.
There's a weird thing that happens though when Cheech knocks her off, because I feel like Alan, I don't know, maybe misread that Olive could be a really popular and not likable, but a performance and a character that people can like, because I feel like at that moment you're really supposed to be kind of siding with Cheech and be like, oh my god, please kill her already because she's so annoying. And it's I feel like it's a little bit of a misread, but you know, when you're making it, you're not going to really know how an audience is going to react.
Right. Well, and tonally, it's also off, too. I mean, the movie just stops being funny at that moment.
Yes.
Well, I remember loving the performance, but being with the bodyguard when she gets knocked off.
So, well, there you go.
Because she is ruining the art. Maybe because
It's called ad-libbing.
Maybe because I hold actressing in such high esteem, but when someone takes up the space that should go to somebody good, it makes me crazy.
Oh my god!
Did you guys realize watching this that there are three of the five are playing actresses in a way?
Is if Mia Wallace is one of them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shame. Five. It's a shame Willem Dafoe was in this category then.
It's a shame who?
Willem Dafoe wasn't in this category.
Oh my goodness.
The moment you've all been waiting for. So world famous Jackrabbit Slim's twist contest. Now this is where one lucky couple will win this handsome trophy that Marilyn here is holding. Now, who will be our first contestants?
Right here. Want to dance?
No.
I do believe Marcellus, my husband, your boss, told you to take me out and do whatever I wanted. Now I want to dance. I want to win. I want that trophy. So dance good.
All right.
I'm here for our first contestant.
Okay, so Pulp Fiction. Who has a story they want to share about their first or subsequent viewings of Pulp Fiction?
I don't know if it's so much of a story, but this was, I was working at a video store at the time, and we were all extreme cinephiles, and we're like, oh my God, you know, Quentin Tarantino worked at a video store, and now he's made this fantastic movie, let's do that too. And so, you know, we made lots of short films and you know, did scenes from other movies and, you know, did our own style to it. But, you know, that just kind of never really went anywhere outside of that. But that's like the best I've got.
Well, I'm sure he did. He obviously inspired a generation of filmmakers because so many people tried to be him afterwards.
Mm-hmm. God, remember those years?
Yeah. Unfortunately.
I remember being excited for this movie because back in 91... A friend of mine and I had just gone to, you know, and seen Reservoir Dogs, kind of not knowing what we were walking into. I think my friend had seen a preview and he was like, it's this funny heist movie. And the trailer scene was like just the scene where they're arguing over what everybody's name is going to be. Uh-huh. So it was like, Mr. Purple. And he was like, oh, it looks hilarious. So we went in. I just remember walking out like 2 hours later, completely traumatized and shell-shocked. I mean, being like, what just happened? And then knowing that this was like the next movie directed by that guy and being like, oh, wow. I don't know. This story doesn't have a good ending other than then I went and saw it and it was great. And actually what struck me watching it again now is how it's so good. It's such a good movie. And one thing that I thought also specifically about the Imitators is that Pulp Fiction is slow. It's not Jack Brown slow, but it's slow. It's a slow movie, and it's amazing to me that you could try to be like a disciple or of Tarantino and make a movie that's all like MTV, yeah, you know, slam cuts and explode.
I.e. True Romance.
Right, and which is from his script, yeah, and think you're doing what he did. There's this movie, the length of some of there's even that whole conversation about like comfortable silences, like,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But well, it's slow.
Yeah, I will say that one of the things that I do for the SmackDown with the amount of screen time for people to say what percentage of the movie they're in, Uma was the easiest performance ever to come up with the screen time, because once Tarantino starts shooting a scene, he just lets it play forever.
Yeah.
So she's just on screen for her entire section of the movie.
to go back to what I said about my experience watching the movie, that is Itamar's point is so true. I mean, I do remember the audience, I'd say a large percentage of which saw Bruce Willis in the credits and thought, well, we're gonna get a Bruce Willis action movie. Mm-hmm. But then when the Bruce Willis section starts and it's that languorous crawl, right, you know, into the basement, picking up the sword, and you could feel the audience adjusting to the movie's rhythms, which is such a rare experience. I mean, I can count on one hand the number of times that's happened.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. He doesn't give the audience too much ahead, so you're just kind of writhing.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's just the confidence of his muscular screenplays. Like, it's completely a voice that is his own. And so you just innately trust those voices, even if you don't agree with what they're saying, when people are that confident.
I teach Pulp Fiction kind of regularly in this film and literature class that I teach that kind of bounces back and forth between different conversations between movies and written texts, and I teach it alongside the flick.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And the first time I tried that class, I think I covered too much historical, like, sweep of, like, 100 years of stuff. And we have these, like, short 9 to 10 week quarters, and so the students just seemed overwhelmed. So the second time I taught it, almost everything was kind of in the last 30 years with just a couple of brief swings back.
Mm-hmm.
And I warned the students of that on the first day in case they'd heard about the class. Like, for better or worse, this will not be the sort of film history kind of coverage course that it was before. And one student stayed after and thanked me for keeping the old movies in the class. And I said, I'm worried you misunderstood me. I actually got rid of most of the old movies. He said, no, but like Pulp Fiction. I'm like, oh, no.
Oh, God.
But in that experience, the students' biggest response to it was how stunned they were by how slow it was. And everything that you guys are talking about just the length of scenes, but even like what you said, Nathaniel, about the length of shots, that they'd expected something sort of much more heavily edited. And I also shared their reaction that, like, as good as I think everybody is, there's, for me, a kind of dynamic by which Samuel L. Jackson is just so completely nailing this movie's idiom already knows his character by the time they shot whatever his first scene was, whereas I feel like John Travolta, kind of like what I feel like with Diane Wiest, like you watch the better performance kind of happen over the course of the film. There's some takes that seem a little big or a little shaky to me, and other ones that it's like all locked down.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just kind of sets a standard that everybody else, as good as they are, I feel like it's hard to measure up. And it's still galling that he was in the category he was in and that he didn't win.
I saw Pulp Fiction a lot of times in the theaters, but in a really specific way where I just saw the Uma Thurman section a lot of times in the theaters, because there was like a dollar movie theater near us when that movie was big. And so as it neared the end of its run and moved to the dollar theater, my friends and I were so obsessed with Uma Thurman and with that movie that we would time it. We would go see something else. And so we would make sure, because it had a ton of screens, this movie theater, we would make sure that we would have time to go over and watch Uma Thurman. And then run back to the other theater and watch the movie we were watching.
You will do anything to not watch a movie scene that has no actresses in it.
Basically.
Nathaniel, how many weeks did Tom and Viv play in that dollar theater?
still playing. It's still there.
Yeah, the crowds were beating down the doors for Tom and Viv.
Now, there's a lot of film nerds on this conference call. Is it true? I had always heard. I mean, there's sort of a larger, like, Quentin-tino verse, right, that his movies all exist in, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And that Travolta's character in Pulp Fiction is Vincent Vega, and Michael Madsen's character in Reservoir Dogs is Vic Vega, and they're brothers.
Yes.
And Quentin-tino intended to make a movie about the two of them that has never materialized. Is that true?
Holy shit. That I didn't know that.
Totally true, yeah. Yes.
Totally true.
Wow.
That's all. I just wanted to confirm that.
Well, this is before this is before every movie was trying to be a universe, so Tarantino is maybe a little bit ahead of his time, but too lazy to actually do it.
Yeah, so he would just drop, like, you know, the cigarettes in every movie, or a car, or like one character name, you know, kind of just keeps peppering throughout most of his films, right. But nothing that fully gels everything together.
So if Tarantino were making Pulp Fiction now, the villain wouldn't be Marcellus Wallace, it would be Loki.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
More to the point, there'd be a universe where King George and Vivian Hague Wood are in the same sanitarium and join forces in some way to be named later.
I like that idea. That's great.
Can Ian Holm still be the head doctor, though?
Yes.
I'm looking at you.
No, Jennifer Tilly would be the head doctor. You're not paying attention.
The mind is labyrinthine.
Ha! Ha!
That's my favorite.
How come none of you have mentioned Uma Oprah?
Oh, right. That was that year, huh?
That was that year.
Yeah. What a knee slapper that was.
Oh, goodness. It was one of those jokes that if you had been high watching the Oscars, it probably would have been really hilarious. Not that I would ever condone being under the influence.
Hey, I was sober and enjoying David Letterman. I'm in the minority.
I guarantee you Helen Mirren was high during those Oscars. Remember her in her tea hat and her veil just cackling the whole time, even when nobody was saying anything?
Maybe she knew that she was going to win every award for playing Queen, so it didn't matter. That whole night didn't matter.
What do we think of Uma, then?
She's great. She's great in this movie. She's great.
Yep. Completely, completely incredible.
I know Nick and I differ on Uma's ability, but I think that she is one of the best Tarantino interpreters. Like, he has such specific dialogue, and I think actors who need dialogue to feel like authentic people talking, like maybe Cheech would have hated Tarantino movies. Cheech from Bullets Over Broadway.
Mm.
He
would have. It would have been too much writing.
Yeah.
Yes. Because
people never actually speak like anybody would speak. And I think Samuel L. Jackson's great at it, obviously. And that's why he's in all the movies. And I think Uma Thurman is great at it. Like, even just simple things like warmer, disco. Like, they're just like, it's just so strange. And something about her within that register works.
Well, I think too, unlike a lot of his characters, I think Tarantino gave Uma Thurman more to do and by far the most rounded character. She kind of gets to play everything. Mm-hmm. In a way that others don't. Others are a little more locked into their type and what their role in the movie is. And I feel like she has so much more to do, and really almost is a co-lead in that sense. She gets to hit every single beat for me of being funny and sympathetic and reserved and super ridiculous and outgoing. She just gets to do everything. And the great thing about it for me is that it never feels like any of those choices in the moment are a misstep, or it's like, here, I should be playing this. It feels just real in a situation in a story that feels completely unreal.
What's interesting is that it's hard to sort of project backwards to how I felt watching it the first time. But what I remember is that I agree completely, and it feels like that's the story beat, right? Like, we know he's going to go out with Marcellus's wife, and we're anticipating like a bombshell, a gangster's mall, maybe like a Jennifer Tilly type character circa 94 or whatever. But in fact, the surprise is that she's a grounded, three-dimensional human who's Vincent's equal in every way. And they even look similar. They have the same, like, hair and skin coloring, and they're dressed in matching out. Like, the joke is, oh, she's your equal. She's you. She's the female you. Mm-hmm. So in order to pull that off, he has to write her that way. Otherwise, the story doesn't work. And I also think it's interesting. I think that she's so beautiful in kind of like this weird alien way. And a lot of her early roles, people were like, she's literally what? Like Aphrodite and Baron von Munchausen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She's like the goddess of love. In Gattaca, she's like, the point is she's a genetically perfect human. Like, that's super boring, right? And I think it leans into maybe what her weaknesses might be. Whereas if you play against that and you let her be goofy and awkward and all the things that she is in this movie, it's way more interesting and she can do it. So yeah.
And I think that's one of Tarantino's biggest strengths, is being able to see past perceptions of what an actor is or can be, and see what they really, really could be.
Yeah, I mentioned that the self-referential self-satisfaction of Woody Allen in Bullets Over Broadway, for me, let down Jennifer Tilly's performance. Here, all that, 50, 60 years of movie lore actually helps Uma Thurman, and the way she plays it, without letting anyone in on the joke, she lets every line just fall without putting undue stresses. It's just a cool small C performance. It's not a great one, but it's a good one. It's exactly what Tarantino needed in that role for that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's about where I am. I feel like I don't think this is a character that needed Uma Thurman to relax, really, which is not something I think Uma Thurman really is great at doing. I feel like she's an actress who I usually feel like I'm watching her do all the things she's doing. It bothers me less in this performance, although sometimes I do get a little mixed up between when Mia's doing something for effect and when Uma's doing something for effect. And there are moments where I think before she's as interested in Vincent as she becomes about halfway through that date, it might have been, I think she might be coming at the beginning of the scene a little hard. But I loved when people were saying before, like, it's hard to remember before the first time you saw this, like the twist scene was already so kind of iconic by the time I even saw it the first time that I had not really stopped to think about other ways it could have been, because it's just always been that. But to understand all the specific things she's doing while she's dancing that do actually feel like character points about how coked up she is, and about how, Nathaniel, what you said, somebody, I'm getting it wrong again, but somebody said she dances as though John Travolta kind of isn't even really there. That was fun, looking at that, those things in her performance, that I do think she's dropping more than she's being given. It's just, it feels like a letdown, right? That there's not like one more time Mia could be in this movie, or
yeah, she's my favorite part of the movie. So the rest of the movie, for me, the slow pacing is that's why that's the scene I would sneak into.
Nathaniel, nobody believes you. That's not why.
No. Did anyone get a sense that Vince and Mia have no sexual chemistry at all?
Yeah.
I wrote about that in my blurb. I sensed that there was almost like Vince was trying to talk himself into feeling excited about her. Obviously, she has surpassed his expectations. He thought, what do you say the first third of the movie, that, oh, it's like taking your best friend's sister or whatever out for dinner. But now it's clear that she's his equal, and he should be excited about it. They don't really generate any sparks, and that's not a criticism at all of the movie. I think that's kind of cool. We should also remember that they're both very high, each on different drugs. So that's probably that's probably a factor too.
Mia's not sexually interested in Vincent at all, right? Like a fun time out. And so if John Travolta were remotely capable of playing somebody who does not believe he's completely transfixing, that would be a really funny scene where he's like talking himself out of a sexual encounter. That's definitely not going to happen. But maybe only Vincent Vega and John Travolta are the two people in the world who think that it's going to.
Right.
That's definitely how I read that bathroom scene, that monologue.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's just trying to keep herself entertained. Like, she has no interest in him.
Yeah. She's like, oh, this is more fun than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, which is a mark of the performance, I think, that you also believe her when they talk about Antoine. Is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
That there was nothing going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Does anybody remember Oliver Stone's fixation on how unpopular Quentin Tarantino was before Pulp Fiction came out?
No.
Like unpopular as a guy, like socially, or
no? with audiences, because this is one of my favorite takeaways of 1994 is there was so much advanced press about Natural Born Killers.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And which I have very mixed feelings about, except for I think Juliette Lewis should have been Oscar nominated. I thought she was so amazing in that.
Yes.
But he said, Oliver Stone said in an interview, because Pulp Fiction was getting all this pre-release buzz, and he said something like this: it's going to make more in opening weekend than a Tarantino movie will in its entire run.
Yeah.
Because I think he was annoyed with people were already thinking Tarantino was the next big thing.
Well, I think that speaks directly to the conversation earlier that Natural Born Killers is the opposite stylistically and visually than Pulp Fiction.
Yes.
Natural Born Killers is the fast editing and crazy angles and colors, and it's the opposite of what Pulp Fiction was. In what could have been a similar, you know, way to tell a story. I mean, imagine if Pulp Fiction was told like Natural Born Killers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to admit I really like Natural Born Killers, but only because it is so insanely obsessed with itself. Mm-hmm. There's just such a sense of conviction behind the mad shit it's doing. And the photography, I think, is kind of... The photography and the sound design, I remember, as being kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would not want to see almost any other movie directed that way.
Yeah.
Imagine the dance sequence directed by Oliver Stone.
With like a roaring wolf projected on a screen behind them. And everything is turquoise until it's orange.
I think,
exactly. Saturated.
I think the waiters at that restaurant in Pulp Fiction would have had a lot more to do.
Like stabbing people.
I just want to circle back and talk for a second about Forrest Gump, not because I like it, but because of what I saw. I remember in 94 seeing it for the first time and being like, oh, that was good. And then seeing it again a couple of years later when I was a little bit older and being like, this is a dangerously reactionary, conservative message film that's about repudiating all the lessons of the 1960s and demonizing the left. And it's astonishing to me, like, how embraced it was by, well, I guess maybe it shouldn't be, but by Hollywood and by, I mean, it's like a subversive movie in the worst possible way.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's worth mentioning on this podcast. Just stumble along through life, questioning nothing, and you'll be the best possible American. But if you join the Black Panthers, you'll die of a terrible disease that we won't quite say what it is, but we all know.
Here's one movie whose popularity, thanks to video and cable showings, has just mystified me, and we haven't mentioned it yet. The Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, I'll never get it.
Yeah, I'll never get it either. Like, I think it's fine, but
totally fine.
No more than
is
that.
Is it too much of an IMDb dude bro movie?
For me, like, is there an actress in it?
No, I was just going to make it.
Can we mention Irene Jacob in Red?
Yes.
That's the movie that after Pulp Fiction totally blew me away at the time.
Pulp Fiction win at Cannes was not super popular because so many people had assumed that Red kind of had it in the bag. And Clint Eastwood couldn't quite get himself there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love... Yeah, Red's a good one.
I saw that with my college roommate, who was a physicist. All three of my freshman roommates were physicists. And they didn't really understand the stuff that I cared about. And one night I was going to go see Red, and one of them asked if he could come with me, because he'd studied abroad in Switzerland. And I said, yeah, great. And we left. And he said, did you like that? I said, I liked it a lot. Did you like it? Like, yeah, I guess. There were just, like... there were all these emotions in it.
He's right. That is true.
Is that what you like about it?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't really want to have to deal with that. You go to a lot of movies. Are they all emotional like this?
Oh my god.
Not like this, but yeah.
As opposed,
it's hard to imagine a cinematic landscape where Red is like every other movie.
Yeah. And like hashtag not all physicists. That was not the point of the story, but Andy, that's a direct quote.
I do remember one other funny Pulp Fiction anecdote, which is that I now recall that I saw it at least three times in the theater. I saw it twice.
Yep.
In the Bay Area where I lived, and then my sister at the time was living in Israel, and I went to visit her later. And movies, you know, come out a little later in foreign countries. So it had the following year, 8 months later, 10 months later, whenever it was, when I was visiting her, Pulp Fiction had just come out in Israel, and I went to see it a third time with her because she had never seen it. And so we were in this audience in, I guess, Tel Aviv with Hebrew subtitles, and the line in the first scene where Tim Roth is talking about robberies and says, oh, you try to rob one of those places, you know, some Jews have owned it for 15 fucking generations, and you've got Grandpa Irving with a sawed-off shotgun in his hand. You get your head blown off robbing for those places. There's just the cheers and applause response to that line was exceeded that in other screenings I was in.
That's fantastic.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining. Thanks again to Itamar Moses.
Thank you.
Nick Davis.
Thank you.
Alfred Soto.
Don't speak.
And Eric Anderson.
Thanks, everybody.
P.S. With these actresses, who would you have put? Pick one. You each get only one example. Move somebody into somebody else's role.
Yeah, Rosemary Harris in Pulp Fiction.
Abby Wallace?
Helen Mirren in Pulp Fiction, which is basically Shadowboxer. But she would have had a blast.
Wow.
Uma Thurman and Tom and Viv.
Well, I guess stranger things have happened with age casting. I have to put Jennifer Tilly in The Madness of King George.
Then I get it.
Perfect.
Okay, but she still has to have the same lines from Bullets Over Broadway. So it's really just, ha!
Trying to make my part even smaller? My part's small enough as it is.